and welcome to the Sound Barrier podcast from Silent London. The Sound Barrier podcast is released fortnightly, and each episode discusses two films, a new release and a classic from the silent era that complements or matches it in some way. And you should know that we do this with spoilers. To find out more, visit silentlondon.co.uk or search for Silent London on iTunes or Stitcher. Now, the Sound Barrier is hosted by me, Pamela Hutchinson. I'm the editor of Silent London, and Pete Barron.
And that's me.
So I just told you the rules of the Sound Barrier, but today we've changed the format up a little. The new release film we want to discuss in this episode is actually silent, so we have plundered the history of sound cinema to find a comparable film. That means that today we are talking about two 21st century animated films, one that's out in cinemas now, and the other, which is a beloved children's favourite. The Red Turtle is a first in the world of animation. It's a Studio Ghibli co-production, being a collaboration between the well-known Japanese outfit and Dutch animator Michael Dudok de Wit. The Red Turtle is actually a Japanese-French-Belgian co-production, and one that is set far away from all those places on a lush, remote desert island. It's also that beast rarer than a giant red sea turtle, a new and very accomplished feature-length film made without dialogue. Now, in this intriguing, mystical movie, a shipwrecked man forms a lasting relationship with a giant red turtle. At first, it's a hostile one, as the turtle repeatedly sabotages the man's attempts to escape the island. But after the man takes his rage out on the beast, the turtle is transformed, spoiler alert, into a young woman. The couple make their life together on the island and raise a son, who soon develops itchy feet just like his father's. And eventually, in some mysterious way, the meaning of this enchanted transformation and the life that follows it may become apparent. What is clear from the outset is that this is a beautifully animated film, with glassy ocean water, soft sand and rustling foliage all rendered in a way that retains the texture of hand-drawn work with the slickness of computer-generated imagery. The use of space, with figures nestled into wide expanses of landscape, reflects Dudok de Wit's affinity with Eastern artistic ideas, and there may be a hint in Japanese culture as to the meaning of the turtle herself. The animated human figures on the island are full of life, if not hugely distinct personalities. We feel their pain, their fear and their happiness, as well as marvelling at the often perilous paradise around them. There are unforgettable moments of crisis in the film, which may make the viewer ponder the relationship between humanity and nature and the circle of life itself. For comic relief, our castaways are accompanied by a supporting cast of amusing animals, notably some scene-stealing crabs on the beach. Now, although Dudok de Wit and his co-writer Pascal Ferran removed the few lines of dialogue they initially wrote into the script, there is a wonderful collage of sound here to support the visuals, some overwhelming sound effects and a gorgeous score by Laurent Perez Delmar. This is not Dudok de Wit's first dialogue-free film, but it is his first to feature more than one character interacting. It's notable that in a recent interview in Sight and Sound, he tipped his hat to the silent animator Winsor McCay among a list of influences. Later, in the same conversation, he refused to be drawn on the symbolism within the film, arguing that some things are better left unspoken by saying that when you talk about symbols, they lose their exquisite magic. That, perhaps, is the only clue you need to unlock the mysteries of the Red Turtle.
And in the other corner, we have Wall-E, or Wall-E, as the lead character refers to himself. Wall-E is Pixar's ninth feature film, and definitely a project of their fated animated studio's Imperial Phase, if you believe in such things. Released in 2008, directed by Andrew Stanton of Finding Nemo fame, it's very much the period where Pixar was coming up with unlikely premises for kids' animations and having tremendous success with them. Here, in the far future, we follow the melancholy days of Wall-E, a trash compactor robot, seemingly the last one left on a deserted Earth. It seems humans have packed off to space until the planet was cleaned up, and that's just the job of our banged-up lead robot. Wall-E spends his days spitting out cubes of Earth's garbage, accompanied by a chirpy cockroach, and collecting odd items of drunk that he deems of note. A Rubik's Cube, a nodding dog, the box for a diamond ring, the ring gets tossed. Evenings are spent rewatching a video of Hello Dolly, which Wall-E has a fondness for, and its songs. We follow this daily routine in a worldless, dusty world until a spaceship turns up and drops off a sleek, futuristic robot who seems intent on scanning everything and blowing up everything else. Nevertheless, Wall-E is obsessed with this newcomer and eventually gets to introduce himself to Eve, or Eva, who seems charmed by him. They literally meet cute, develop a relationship, and then Eve discovers a plant that Wall-E has found, at which point she goes into hibernation mode and is eventually picked up by a spaceship to return with a love-struck robot, Wall-E, in tow. At this point, the movie flips from being a weirdly contemplative, near-silent love story to something a little bit more frenetic, a race for survival against an evil AI on a spaceship. The designs of more robots and the morbidly obese people that humans have turned into are never less than impressive, and the film maintains its emotional air through the calamitous action. But when I first saw it, 9 years ago, I pined for the first section, though it is still one of the most impressive science fiction films of this century and managed to tell a much bigger story about consumerism, waste and environmentalism, which got it in trouble with the right-wing press. Despite this, Wall-E was the biggest film of 2008, won the Oscar for Best Animation, and is an interesting case study not only for its multiple storytelling modes, its non-human leads and its environmental message, but also seeing what, 9 years later, has dated. And oddly, its contemplative apocalyptic opening is not dissimilar to the tone set in The Red Turtle, and that's the part that's aged best of all.
Out there's a world outside of Yonkers, way out there beyond this hick town, Barnaby. There's a slick town, Barnaby. Out there, full of shine and full of sparkle. Close your eyes and see it glisten, Barnaby. Listen, Barnaby.
Right, so I think we've got two great films, and I'm sure a lot of people have discussed Studio Ghibli versus Pixar, which maybe isn't going to be the most productive angle for us, but it's our fifth Sound Barrier podcast. How are you getting on?
It's doing all right, yeah. It's interesting to do something new.
Yeah, four episodes really drained you. And
No. I mean, not so much that, just because it's just interesting to talk about a silent film that isn't strictly a silent film. It's a dialogue-free film, but its soundscape in The Red Turtle is very important. And equally, when Wall-E came out, a lot of the criticism around it, or a lot of the notices about it, talk about the opening section, which is dialogue-free itself, and how the film shifts when dialogue and action gets much more involved. And I think they're really a really interesting pair.
Yeah, I mean, I was delighted to see how much they had in common. The fact that they both have, in some ways, kind of environmental messages, in some ways they're both creation myths. There's a lot to talk about here, but I think you hit the nail on the head, as you always do, Pete. We should talk first about what constitutes a silent film and whether these have what it takes to be a silent film. And I'd like to do one of my mini rants.
Do it.
So I do think that in both of these films, either silent sequences, obviously Red Turtle is all silent, have fantastic sound effects and beautiful music. And it feels like we don't want to dismiss that by talking about them as silent films. People say, oh, well, you know, of course, the score's very important. Well, the thing is, the score can be very important and the sound effects can be very important. But I think that when we're talking about silent cinema, we're talking about telling stories visually, and we're talking about telling stories without using expository dialogue or voiceover. So it's not a criticism of the beautiful sound effects work on the fantastic scores on either film to say that one of them all the way through and one of them for at least half of it are silent films. Yeah, you know,
I agree. And I think what's interesting is how, I mean, even in Wall-E, so Wall-E has a good 20 minutes which you would call absolutely silent.
Yeah,
then you have, well, perhaps with the exception of the song, but that doesn't matter, and we'll come on to that, I'm sure. Then we have the introduction of a character, and in much the same way that the Red Turtle does, they do talk to each other, but don't say anything to each other. And it's something that if there was no diegetic sound there, you would know exactly what was going on still.
Exactly,
know?
Yeah. And, you know, I mean, you could have a character of someone who's just stumbling around a desert island by themselves and constantly muttering. It doesn't matter if it's inconsequential.
Exactly, yeah.
Exactly. So, you know, I think I really wanted at first to pair The Red Turtle with All Is Lost, which starts off with a little bit of narration, which is disappointing, but it's nothing you can do with an intertitle. And then I think he swears halfway through, doesn't
he?
Yeah, he does swear. But, you know, really, that's not adding to the narrative. That's just more richness in the film. I mean, who doesn't want to hear Robert?
I mean, he tries to record a message at some point on his broken radio, and then realizes. But I mean, we're not talking about All Is Lost, and I vetoed it because it's too depressing. I couldn't watch it again.
I disagree. I really, really like it. You know, I'm obviously happier with my place in the world.
I think these are a better pairing, though, because I think they, in some ways, because they do bring out some things about each other which are really interesting, and different styles of animation, and also what you can and can't do in a animated silent film.
So I had two things that sort of occurred to me when I was watching Wall-E, what are we calling it?
Wall-E, I think.
Because I always used to call it Wall-E.
Yeah, yeah.
It was Wall number E.
he is kind of good. He calls himself Wall-E.
Well, it's so. Wall-E like Dolly, right?
Yeah,
because
exactly.
It's all about him.
Hello, Wall-E.
We could get into that, you know. He's the only person ever to hate Wall-E.
He's just a little tramp in the future.
He's a little buster. Yeah. A trash compactor buster. Dust buster.
Dust buster. There you go. Dust Buster Keaton, as we call him now.
Dust Buster Keaton. I love that. Okay, so I felt that, you know, and you see this a lot with the Pixar films, actually they're really, really good at visual storytelling. Mm. And they put in these silent sequences, like the little heartbreaking sequence at the beginning of Up, or things like that. But, you know, even when we were in the very dialogue-heavy bits on the cruise ship, the cruise spaceship towards the end, a lot of it is being shown visually. I mean, yep. You know, you don't really need to hear what the guy's saying to the computer. But you can tell what's happening because we're just looking. I mean, it's got a beautiful visual image of keeping that little plant in the little boot alive.
What they're doing is obviously they're considering who their audience is. And, mm-hmm. I mean, since Pixar have been around and thinking about my friends who are parents, I mean, these are the first things they show their kids. You know, they're guaranteed, they're good quality, they are rewatchable, mm-hmm. and also they are not intolerable to parents.
Unlike, because there's a richness there, as much as anything else.
So, you know, I know people who've seen, you know, shown Wall-E to 3-year-olds, 4-year-olds, who won't get a lot of the language. So if the visual storytelling doesn't work, then it's not going to work.
What I always heard was that the makers of Wall-E, while they were making Wall-E, so I presume when they were sort of script writing it, pre-production, rather than actually in the thick of it, they watched every Buster Keaton and every Charlie Chaplin film. Well, I would say, you know, I'd like a job at Pixar. But, you know, I think it does show. And what I find is interesting is that what they've done with that is they've learned about, or they've enhanced their use of visual storytelling, not necessarily comedy. What Wall-E's not that funny. We'll get onto that.
No, it isn't as funny as it might be. Though, yeah. But there are definitely shots. I mean, there's a wonderful shot when they're on the spaceship of a whole load of mad robots careening around the corner, which is straight out of Keaton. I mean, it's literally out of Cops.
Absolutely, yeah. There are aspects. You might have thought that it'd be non-stop sort of pratfalls, and it really isn't. I mean, some of the gags are just, you know, like when he throws the box away and keeps the diamond ring. It's a gag, but it's really quite poignant, and it's saying something else.
Yes, exactly. It says, what does this character, what does it value? And the other things. So there's that aspect of its non-humans there, but also just here's a really good gag, but let's not just do a gag that is meaningless. Let's do a gag that has a purpose.
Yeah, because, you know, you could be falling over bits of junk and running around the spaceship all the time, you know, but actually, yeah, a lot of the humour in Wall-E has got a point. And then I was thinking about the red turtle. Now, you said, just before we came into the office, the studio even, sorry, we're in a studio, we're already fancy. You said, you know, that you thought the red turtle was pretty hypnotic. Mm. And, you know, that made me think, you know, that's what you say about silent films. That's what one says about silent films. That's the experience. And I think, you know, in the tsunami sequence, we can't worry about spoilers at this point because we've given away the biggest one of them all.
There's a tsunami.
I mean, you know, that's quite ferocious. And yet, you know, it's also very powerful visually. I don't think anyone in that movie screening is looking at their phone thinking, oh, it's just a tsunami. I'll just look up when they start talking.
I mean, one of the things that, because I rewatched Wall-E literally just before I saw The Red Turtle. And was intrigued that they're both, I think The Red Turtle's about 10 minutes shorter. And so much happens in Wall-E. Literally so much. I mean, it takes over a much shorter period of time. But so much is happening there. And there are so many characters. And there are so many ways of introducing things and so on. And, you know, and you have that sort of refreshing thing when you go into a film like The Red Turtle where, okay, it takes over the period of a whole person's life or the second half of someone's life. But actually, incident-wise, 5-6 actual incidents.
Yeah, absolutely. And a lot of them are crises that are resolved. So, yeah. I mean, not an anticlimax.
No. But, you know, these are things that get solved. Mm. And, you know, and we get to a point and it's all about someone's life. And yet it doesn't feel slow.
No.
Whereas Wall-E does feel a bit rushed in places.
Wall-E definitely feels rushed.
Yeah, and frenetic. And it's all, I mean, I'd be interested to see how kids respond to The Red Turtle, because I do think that young kids might like it. I think there's a patch in the middle who would be terribly bored by it.
Yeah.
And then older kids and adults. It feels like more of an adult film, even though it is very simple. It's PG. It's not you.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's PG just because of the moments of violence and crisis.
Yeah.
You know, I think Do Dr. Witt said that he read Robinson Crusoe at an early age or something, or saw a film version or something like that. I think kids like the idea of the desert island and the cute crabs, but there are things happening here that are quite dark. And we talk about, you know, the character feels stranded.
Yeah.
Two of the characters particularly feel very, very stranded and very, very distressed about being where they are. And I think when the turtle scuppers the raft each time, it's actually pretty terrifying.
Yeah, no, yeah, absolutely. Yeah, yeah, yeah. I would agree.
If we were going to say, you know, which one works better as a silent film, the correct answer, I think, is the Red Turtle, obviously, but Wall-E is very, very close. And, you know, I think you could probably follow a lot of it without the dialogue, because it's all about images, you know, like the little beating, pulsing green leaf.
Even though we're talking about two robots here, they are physically affectionate to each other. They are holding hands. They want to dance. They all of that stuff is there. And as you say, because, you know, I mean, Wall-E is more anthropomorphic than a lot of the robot characters, because he's got these eyes that move and so on.
Oh, those eyes! When he gets them slightly misaligned and has to put them back in.
So yeah, there's lots of visual storytelling going on there. But yeah, I mean, there is still a lot that then when it becomes the other film, it becomes, because I do think it is kind of two films that is more dialogue heavy, and I think
a lot of that is just chatter, though, isn't it? Yeah.
I think what's really interesting, and I did look at some of those reviews from when it came out, and it was all about. So many people were hankering off for more of that first half, and the second half was just a standard, you know, animated film. And you wonder whether Pixar lost their nerves, Pixar Disney as it was at the time, lost their nerve, or whether that was always going to be the plan. I mean, I can certainly imagine they lost their nerve, because
would be very bold, especially for the mass audience and the children's audience that they were going for. You know, really, I think the definition of success for a Pixar film is that everybody loves it.
Indeed,
you know, whereas, you know, The Red Turtle, I mean, I think that The Red Turtle is, I mean, it's a kind of 4 out of 5 movie. For me, it's not perfect, but I think it's great, and I think everyone would like it. I recommended it to a friend today, and they just said, we're not going to see a dialogue-free animation. He called himself a Philistine, but, you know, people think, oh, this is going to be hard, and perhaps because it's a foreign film as well, and though, of course, the point about being a silent film is that doesn't matter.
It's the very definition of not being hard. I mean, it really is about as universal as you can get. You might find it slow.
Yeah. I'd love to see a kind of remake of Wall-E that goes silent all the way through. There's some great guys. I mean, on the cruise ship, you know, you just need to look at those fat blobs. And, you know, of course, if you wait till the end, the title sequence at the end has all this, like, the history of the world from then on, like, the development, evolution, we'll go into that. So I think we're both going to vote for the Red Turtle.
I think that's correct.
Okay, so that's two turtles coming right up, but we will say special mention to Wall-E.
Yeah, yeah, it comes close, you know, it really comes close. And I think if it had gone all the way, it would be a more outstanding film, but it's still a pretty good film. I mean, it was one of my top 10 films of that year. I think I could look back at my list. What can I say?
You like a list. And so yeah, it's good to know you liked it the first time. It's not just because it's got, you know, cool cred. Because
It's
appeared on the Sound Barrier podcast.
Indeed.
So, yes. Talk about animation next.
Yeah, these are both animated films.
Great. Okay, so that's done. So they're both animated films, and they've both got very different styles.
Yes. The Red Turtle is a mixture of European and Japanese animation, I would say. European for the character design and some of the character animation, but the I would say the backgrounds very much feel very much more Japanese. It fits into that kind of art history. It is beautiful.
Yeah, that's half the way it's hypnotic. I mean, I was very much overwhelmed. I saw it at the London Film Festival, a press screening, so, you know, I had heard a lot about it, but, you know, didn't know lots and lots of people had seen it. And I just sat back and enjoyed it. Really, really just, you could let it wash over you, which is completely the wrong verb to use.
We've got ocean effects, as well as the hand-drawn stuff. There is the very sophisticated computer background effect stuff that's going on, which is mainly sea, sky, and some birds and some background, but is there to add texture. There's lots of very clever light texture work being done there, because the character animation itself is pretty flat 2D and yeah, you know,
they've got
you're not,
quite blank faces.
Yeah, very blank faces in places. Yeah. He's got, they've all got very, very sharp noses. That was something they really are, you know, 5 year old how to draw a face, the sort of two line nose. But then there are only three characters. Human characters, of course, we need to talk about.
All about the crabs.
Yes.
I really shouldn't say that. What's beautiful about the animation in The Red Turtle is that it has this kind of, it kind of looks hand done, even though it isn't. And there are some aspects of it that are just beautiful. Sometimes the light, sort of magic hour light as they're sort of romping around the grass, or the deep glassy ocean. It looks so gorgeous. And you feel a little bit, that's one of the things that helps you get into the character, because if you're going to be stranded far and away from everything you know and everyone you love, and knowing you're going to die alone, or feeling you're going to die alone, but you're in the most beautiful, I mean, it's heavenly, literally, that's the right word.
There are muted colours about it. The island is not paradise. It's not the classic desert islands where it's always sunny and it's always pleasant.
Yeah, you know. But you know, that's because it's going to, you know, you can grow things there.
Yes, exactly. Yeah.
The whole point of it is just saying, like, this has got everything that you need to survive is here.
Yeah, just about. I mean, I still think there's something ambivalent about the way the island is presented. It isn't so beautiful that you think, oh, well, he can die happy there. Falls down some rocks, you know, there's moments of peril, yeah.
And also, I think, well, even, you know, most like disagree on how beautiful the island is, but there's a massive incident, the tsunami, as we say, where the island becomes much less beautiful, less habitable. Suddenly, it sort of shows its true dangers to the surface, and they're all separated, and it's a very distressing twist in the landscape.
Unlike many desert island narratives, the lead man, does not bend the island to his will. Mm. He doesn't build any structures at all, apart from his rafts, his constantly destroyed rafts. When he has his turtle bride, doesn't build her a house. He isn't building Heath Robinson-esque water delivery purification systems like you get in Swiss Family
Robinson.
He's
actually quite hapless. I mean, she has to teach him how to live on the island.
He
would die there if it wasn't for her.
Yes, exactly.
Which I think is something we could talk about.
But the island itself is, and the kind of design of the island is, as you say, done quite simplistically. You know, it's a beach, it's a jungle, and it's some rocks, and then the sea.
The sea.
Oh, the heavenly sea.
The sea. So it's interesting when you talk about detail in and the human characters, their little sharp noses. Again, we have very blank humans in Wall-E. In fact, so Wall-E has a lot of detail. Dustbuster Keaton has a lot of detail. But then Eve, or Eva, is almost defined by very blank curves. I mean, her parts don't even join together. I mean, it's like she's been designed by Apple.
She's an iPod.
Like, this is what our iPods will look like in the future, and they'll be amazing. They have floating arms. And then, you know, the humans themselves, they're just these, like, balloons, because they've been on this cruise ship, because they don't walk around. They've lost their bones, but they all just look like amorphous, balloony blobs. And, yeah, they don't have much detail in their features at all.
No, the story isn't about them until, unfortunately, it kind of becomes about them. Mm. And there's a very strange thing there as well. And I remember at the time being not a fan of this aspect of the film, which is basically there's some live action footage of Fred Willard, human spokesman for Big and Large.
It's almost like they're trying to say something there about corporations.
Who knows? The big box store that seems to have taken over the world. Because then when you get the development of the human characters, which are very much of the Pixar human style, which is, you know, flat skin, bulging bits, but they look human, but they are clearly animated because of the whole issue of the uncanny valley that they've constantly wrestled with. So they are very animated, and there is a bit of a cognitive dissonance between the two. But on the general, the animation, of course, you're looking at Pixar here, and they, particularly on Earth, have built a world which is fantastically detailed.
Oh, it's incredible. You know. The scrapyard that is the planet Earth.
Yeah. And because all of those bits are bits of, I mean, if you freeze frame at any second, a bit of rubbish will not just be a bit of rubbish. It will be a soft drinks can, or it will be a shopping trolley, or whatever. But at the same time, there's a very clever use of perspective and lighting and so on to get a sense of this dusty world. They spoke to Roger Deakins, I think, in the making of it, to talk about how light and how cinematography would work to give those sort of faded backdrops of just endless rubbish.
One of the things that Wally says, does, which we can say absolutely and pretty certain the Red Turtle is not interested in doing, is it constantly making film references. So you've got this animated film about a little Dustbuster Keaton almost every 5 minutes being 2001.
Yes, yeah.
And, you know, that's definitely where they're aiming.
I mean, I think they're actually really quite insecure about the film when they're making it, because it's non-human leads or non-anthropomorphic leads at all. A big reach, a love story between two robots set in a post-apocalyptic world. And so I think there is that bit where, unlike a lot of Pixar films, they do feel the need to go, this one's for the parents, or this one's for, you know, which is unlike them. Very few of them fail. There's a few clunkers and a few which have actually dated it quite badly. Mm. The Windows boot up sound that turns up three times in it when is a sound that no one would know now.
I've no idea what you Windows.
I know you're an Apple person. But equally, because the Apple iPod that's in there. And yeah, I think the 2001 reference actually is probably one of the clunkiest of them. Partially because the evil robots leans on Hal a bit with its big red eye. But there is a sort of a 2001 musical montage moment, which I think feels a little bit too heavy-handed. But when it leans on other types of things like Hello Dolly, musicals in general, things that aren't science fiction, when it leans on those things, I think it does really well.
I think it's very hard, and I'm sure that someone who knows about it will come along and tell me that what Pixar did is much more difficult, but I much prefer the look of the Red Turtle. Despite everything about Wall-E is clever, but it's just like, this is what happens when you get like 120 billion people in a room animating. How many people do they have? Not that many.
A lot, yeah, not billions. 120 million is more than people on planet Earth, so...
Wow, with the facts.
I know. But yeah,
you're good at maths, though.
Yes, well, sometimes. Yeah, you're looking at least 5,000 people animating this film, and that's why I'm going to go for it. No, I think because I really admire what the Red Turtle does. I really do, but I think it's not just that Wall-E has so much in it, it's that everything in it is there for a reason. And I think there are so many clever things about character design. Even though I do think it is overstuffed, and even though I do think it is frenetic in places, I do think that the weight and the heft and the sense of the animation just works for me.
Your reasonings are excellent.
As were yours.
Oh, thank you so much. We'll have to cut this. Can't be nice to each other. Okay, so we're going to talk about the environment next, because someone already should.
Yes, and let's be clear, we've got climate change deniers to the left and to the right.
Absolutely.
But in this studio, and I'm being bold in saying this, but I think we both think that climate change is a real issue in the world at the moment.
And I'm sure, we'll try to do our bit. Donald over there does not... You're drinking some water from a bottle that you've filled up from the tap.
Yes, from a tap, and it says Solar SOAS on it, because we are recording this in SOAS Radio, and on the roof directly above us, there are solar panels.
This is a solar-powered podcast.
Yeah, it doesn't quite go into the studio, but let's say it is, yes.
Yeah, let's say it is. Okay, so I will talk about the Red Turtle first, I think, because it's not so obvious where the environmental message is. I think the hero of the film, he's shipwrecked, right? But he's very, very unsuited to living in nature.
Yes, he doesn't seem very good at it. His first stumblings are quite hapless.
Yeah, he's really, and it takes the turtle woman to teach him how to make the most of the sort of biosystem that he's got. And I think that's quite interesting. Again, that makes me think a little bit of All Is Lost, about, you know, there you've got a chap who's got a fancy yacht but doesn't actually know how to sail properly. You know, and again, this guy, you know, he obviously knows enough to go to sea in whatever capacity, but he can't actually exist on this desert island very well. His first thought is to leave. And then something happens halfway through the film, well, a bit further than that, a bit of devastation, which suggests there is a possibility that something really bad has happened elsewhere on the planet. Now, this is a bit of a stretch, but I think the tsunami, we are led to believe, has a cause, and that is possibly why the mystical turtle has kept our man alive on the island.
It's an interesting reading, and it's not one that I picked up, though I did get the sense of the tsunami being based on some kind of phenomena, be it natural or not.
Meteorite, nuclear explosion.
Or earthquake, you know.
I mean, oh, just an earthquake. Well, yeah. That could be...
Because when you think about, you know, the sort of big tsunamis of the last, of our lifetime, and then they have been earthquake-based and have had, you know... And, of course, Japan having suffered a really major one recently, Fukushima. I think the environmental stuff, I mean, what the red turtle is really doing is doing that whole man and nature and man back to nature, and if man lives with nature, then man will do well. Hippity-dippy-clap-trap, if you will.
The turtle protects his baby.
There is an issue, though, around this, because, of course, he kills a turtle.
Yes, but...
She only comes when he has basically killed the turtle.
Yeah, I mean, but then, of course, she becomes a turtle again. We are going all out for spoilers here.
Yeah, it's... Yeah.
I mean, it's 120... Just go see the red turtle, and you won't regret it, no matter how many spoilers you get.
Indeed. The turtleness of the woman and the fact that she becomes...
She's a mutant turtle.
But she's not a teenager, I don't think. I hope not, because as soon as she becomes a woman... There are suggestions as well around, you know, man versus nature when he is trying to get away from the island on his raft. The turtle constantly thwarts that. Mm. And that's man versus nature. When he's back on the island with his turtle bride, things seem to go a lot more swimmingly. Mm. You know, even their offspring can happily put a crab in its mouth and then spit it out and realise that it wasn't supposed to do that. That's an interesting thing around the use of nature and so on. Certainly the characters fish and eat mollusks and so on. Mm. The island doesn't have much more in the way of animal life on it and so on.
But you don't need animals.
No, indeed. No, you don't. But again, the classic Robinson Crusoe type thing would be that's sort of step two is hunting.
Yeah. Kill a boar.
Kill a boar.
But obviously the environmental message of Wall-E is more obvious, so obvious, as you said in your intro, that, you know, it got a few people hot and bothered. It's basically saying that we have destroyed the planet. It's said in the future, we have destroyed the planet with our rampant consumerism, and actually space as well is clogged up with all the satellites. It's disgusting, isn't it? It's a real state. And many, many, many years later, life grows and at the end of the film, people come back and start populating Earth, and they work the land.
Indeed, they plough the fields and scatter.
You know, again, similarly, they eat fish in that end sequence, but they don't. Yeah. We don't get into the icky business of slaughtering land animals.
I mean, actually, the plot of Wall-E doesn't work. Basically, Wall-E's left on there with other trash compactor friends. So the version of Charlie Chaplin to his Dustbuster Keaton, if you will, you know, and then they send these life pods back to see if there's any, if any growing, self-sustaining growing life is there.
Like the probes we sent to Mars.
In the meantime, A, he's got his best buddy is a cockroach, and I know there is a classic sort of all that'll be left of the apocalypse is cockroaches and Twinkies, both of which do survive this.
And doesn't the cockroach live inside a Twinkie occasionally? Just hide inside it. Which is really, really gross.
But also, you know, the film is quite happy to stay slap bang in the middle of North America. I mean, it is a very imperialist view. Yeah,
there's a world beyond Yonkers.
Yes, indeed. Yeah, Barnaby. the American imperialist view of an apocalypse as well, because it's their apocalypse. It's the one that they've caused and the one that they go into a big American store. We don't see the sea. We don't see what's happened to what would be the prairie or other parts of the world.
It's like on the cruise ship where that woman accidentally goes to the pool and she's like, I didn't even know we had a pool. You know, they're not interested in going to the coast.
Its satire is broad and quite well pointed in places and is akin to the same that Mike Judge did in Idiocracy. Mm-hmm. You know, it's very much a parallel to that, or a kid's version of that. You know, the air is breathable when they come down. It'll be nasty, but it's not like poisonous. I mean, the idea is basically they get sent out in space for 5 years whilst the world cleans itself up, and then they stay there because they decide
hundreds
not to do that.
Hundreds of years.
Yeah, so they end up there for hundreds of years. And yeah, I mean, the actual plot doesn't work if you actually want to look at that. Of course, that's not the point. It's a satire. It's saying to, if a 3-year-old or 4-year-old watches, and if their first film was Wall-E, then let's hope that they recycle a bit more. They use less junk.
Yeah, well, so this is another of the things where I think it falls down. Despite, I mean, it's just irresistible in many ways. Oh, so we're being very picky.
We're being mean to a lovely film. But
I mean, it's interesting to me that, you know, the evil AI is a kind of villain, and the fact that, you know, the satire is that all the humans on the cruise ship Axiom, they're all tapped into their, like, basically tablets. They've basically all got iPads, even though they're sort of, they're like
hover chairs.
Hover chairs, that's what they are. They're hover chairs that they go around in. But actually, the whole film's made by computers.
Yeah.
So, you know, there's that. But also, I think, you know, we talk about rampant consumerism and there's too much junk, but actually, the things that Wall-E saves, you know, they become really useful. Mm. And he, with his pure heart, where he throws away the diamond ring and keeps the box, he saved just enough American tat to keep the place going.
Yes, it does seem to be. I was talking to an archaeologist friend of mine and saying we were doing this, and she mentioned that Wall-E is an archaeologist.
Yeah.
And fundamentally, what he's, and what's interesting about him is that he's doing exactly what they do. The stuff that he finds interesting are exactly the things that that an archaeologist finds interesting. They're not interested in the ring. They're interested in the box. They're interested in the hinges. Wall-E likes a Rubik's Cube because it's an interesting thing to look at. When Eve solves the cube...
I know, it's so disappointing.
I mean, if he realises he could easily, you know...
Yeah.
And again, that's a question for us about utility versus beauty. The Eve sleek white styles versus Wall-E's junky, you know,
oh, we all like dustbin. Him because he's a little bit more, you know, rubbish.
Yeah.
Basically, we all love rubbish. Is the,
yeah, he's
is
a cute,
he's
a cute little tramp. I mean, yeah. that is...
He's even got his boot.
You know, it doesn't surprise me that they looked at a lot of silent films. And I would absolutely certainly say that they looked at Chaplin and they looked at some of those characters to see how you can present yourself in a silent way and be lovable. So, you know...
And then, of course, you know, Wall-E hammers it home again with the final... you know, I have to mention it because it's the law. I've recently gone vegan.
No.
See, I mentioned it. One of the things that's interesting about veganism, I think, that is a lot of people find out their information about it or get persuaded to go vegan by watching documentaries. And a lot of these documentaries are just terrible. And I don't understand why, because I think it's an interesting topic. We need more good vegan films.
Mm.
I think Okja, the new film that was playing at Cannes, that sounds quite interesting, about the super pig, and obviously Simon Amstel's Carnage was quite nice. At some point, Wall-E becomes a bit of a vegan film where he talks about, oh, we're going to grow plants, and with the plants we will grow food, and the guy's, yes, we can grow a pizza plant. And that is exactly how a vegan's mind
works. Texture protein, you say? Well, in which case, let's see what textures we can bend it into.
I can make you a plant-based pizza any day. I think we are ready to score. Would you like to go first?
Well, yeah, I mean, I think this is, are we using environmentalism with a big E or a small E? Or just the Wall-E? I'm going to go for Wall-E because obviously it's so smooth. Yeah, I'm going to go for Wall-E because I think it does more with it, though. And also, I think if we want a film that is going to be influential to the next generation, then that's the one.
The UN should be telling people to watch Wall-E to think about some of these things.
Yes.
But actually, yeah, Wall-E wins this one hands down for me. And partly because my reading of The Red Turtle is that it has a strong environmental message, but I'm yet to find someone who agrees with me. So I'm right and everyone else is wrong.
It's because it's in nature, and so therefore he loves nature, right? Because he ends up loving a turtle.
Wow, it's like you're inside my head.
I know.
Did you notice that I'm wearing a turtle necklace?
I hadn't seen that.
Yeah, I'm wearing a turtle necklace for this. It's Tatty Divine. It's very nice. It's not red. Time like this, Peter, that my mind turns to romance.
Well, it is that time of the day, and I've got my romantic voice on.
Wow. Ladies, Wally. Calm yourself down.
Wally. So can I have a little mini rant here?
Yes, please do.
Wall-E is not a romantic film.
Thumbs up.
Both films have an issue where there are only one viable partner left, and so therefore they go for
nothing
it.
Nothing sexier than that.
There's nothing sexier than that, that everyone else is dead or there's no one else around, so you're with me. Now, in The Red Turtle, is that the world has arranged it, or the fable, or the world has arranged the man to get his woman from the dead turtle, what he killed. In Wall-E, yeah, I get that Wall-E might be a bit nuts because he's been left alone for a long time and so on. But he's a bit of a stalker creep, followed by being a little full-on, followed by, well, he basically Weekend at Bernie's Eve for a good week or so, but dragging her around, though she is to all intents and purposes in hibernation stroke dead, dressing her up and so on. So rewatching that again was like, this is kind of some of that toxic stuff I teach students about not being and not doing.
I mean, I think it's interesting that both people say, oh, it's a romance, and, you know, it really isn't romantic. They're basically pals, okay?
Yeah.
But if you assume that in both films it's a romance, then people think, oh, it's quite fun, it's a bit of a sort of meet cute, it's a bit aloof, it's because they're hostile at first, mm-hmm. you know. I mean, Wally thinks that Eva's trying to come to kill him, and she's like zapping lasers everywhere, and obviously the red turtle is, you know, scuppering the raft each time. So I think people start thinking, oh, well, it's kind of interesting because they hate each other, then they love each other. But really, there's
which is how all romance works.
Absolutely.
If film have thought of anything.
I hate you because you're so handsome. Now I love you because you're mine. So, yeah, that's life. I mean, yeah, they don't do too well with romance. There's something interesting, I think. Both of them use sort of hand-holding as a sort of motif for, you know, old-fashioned romance and real love. I think that Wally is in some ways a romantic because he watches that scene in the film and he obviously longs for love. Mm. That's very Chaplin. But you know, this is his first girlfriend.
Yeah.
You know, this is like his first sort of high school girlfriend, and that's why it's all a bit awkward and messy.
Yes. Yeah, I was perhaps being a little bit over-analytical in looking at some of his behaviour at that point.
It's for children.
Yeah. And, you know, and he travels the universe for her. He holds onto the outside of a spaceship for her.
I've never met a man who would do that for me.
And she's kind of annoyed at the end when he keeps mucking stuff up for her.
Yeah.
But, and yeah, and actually, I think when you say that kind of Chaplin thing there, it is a lot like a lot of those kind of relationships where the guy is chasing the unattainable mm-hmm. perfect woman. And
I mean, Chaplin hardly ever ends up with a girl.
No, exactly. And you know, here there's an ending, if you want to finish proper, the proper ending of Wally, where he doesn't end up with a girl. He gets mind wiped, obviously, and the sentimental ending that the film throws us is one for the kids, but I'm sure wasn't the original ending.
So I mean, one of the problems I have with the romance in The Red Turtle, although everything is, you know, it's very natural and things like that, is that I think we can allow the idea that they do fall in love because there's a mystical element here. So it's not like they're two people who just happen to be cast away with each other. There's a reason she is there. Some higher power, God or nature, has placed this beautiful young woman in his arms on a paradise. But one of the things I find quite disappointing, and I understand why it would be difficult for the film to do it, but she's the blankest character.
Oh, absolutely,
and you want to
yeah.
know what is up with this woman who was a turtle. I mean, how does she feel? Is she... Could there is no moment where she seems bewildered by what's happened, as if she doesn't know, and yet if she does know something, she's not really letting on.
Well, it's odd. Once she climbs out of the shell, cracks out the shell.
When she comes out of the shell,
yeah, and kind of wanders around. I mean, her first sort of 5 minutes, she's more than blank. She's kind of clueless. He's standoffish from her. He doesn't know what she is, how she's there, and all that kind of stuff.
Well, he also probably feels a little bit guilty.
Yeah, because he killed the turtle. Though, you know, I'm not unclear why he's not going around killing more turtles. She does. There is this bit where he's obviously unsure of her and stands off from her, and she's in the water, and then they slowly come together. But yeah, as you say, there's nothing to her really. I mean, it's like the kid is given at least a little bit. I mean.
The kid's got far more personality.
Yeah.
He has wants and desires.
Yeah, he's got wants and desires. He shows anger, rage, other emotions apart from blank obsequiousness and eating muscles.
Yeah.
Which is kind of all she does.
Yeah, she's... the word is help meat, I think.
No, it is, yeah.
Yeah. And one of the things that I think that they both express better than romance is loneliness.
Yes.
Actually. And, you know, you do see that Wally does seem lonely, and that's partly just because his eyes naturally look quite sad, which is, you know, something they've designed into it.
Indeed, yeah.
You know, and with the man in the red turtle, he's lonely, and that's one of the reasons he wants to escape. I mean, he's terrified of the idea of being there alone.
Yeah.
He doesn't put a lot of energy into making a good life for himself on the island by himself. He just puts his energy into getting out.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, loneliness leading to romance, it's tricky. It's really tricky.
It is, and I think it's a tricky thing to say in films which may be ostensibly aimed at kids as well.
Mm.
You know, these are the kind of things that I'm trying to tell people. No, you don't need a partner to complete you. You don't need this stuff. And
the future of the human race depends on it. So.
No, no. And as you say, Wally and Eve, you know, they're mates, right? They're mates. It's not really romance. Okay. We can go for that.
I'm going to go for The Red Turtle because I think the end sequence with the flipper is quite nice.
Yes, yeah, when they, yeah, spoiled it all, but yes.
You don't want to vote for either of them. You hate them both.
I don't want to vote for either of them on romance, but on if we're going to talk about loneliness, if that's going then I'll go for Wall-E.
Okay.
Because I think it's better at showing where loneliness gets you and how desperate you are to not be lonely. But, you know, I think they're both, but neither of them are romantic, dear listener.
Safe and strong, it only takes a moment to be loved a whole life long.
There are some other relationships in these films, and I really wanted to call this category scuttling sidekicks.
Yes.
So we're going to talk about the comedy and the comic relief in each film. Would you like to go first?
The cockroach in Wall-E and the crabs in The Red Turtle have the same purpose. And, Wall-E has a whole load of other characters later on. But I think what's interesting from a sort of animal psychic point of view is that cockroach is about the furthest you'll ever think Disney would go. yeah. And crabs are quite far off, but there's a crab in Little Mermaid.
Yeah, I mean, these crabs are quite minxy, they're troublesome, they've got real character, they've got far more character than the humans. I loved it. I mean, I went on holiday a few weeks after I saw this film, and when I saw crabs on the beach, I thought, oh, it's just like the Red Turtle, clapping my hands with delight, and everyone around me hadn't seen the film, obviously, because it hadn't been released in the cinema yet.
So. And of course, you being a vegan didn't pop one in your mouth to give it a go, like the young child here does.
No, and also because I was on all-inclusive, so what's the point?
And, you know, and because the human characters and the crabs themselves, there's not an awful amount of character animation on there.
No.
So, you know, what you have is movement.
Yeah.
You don't really have much more. There's no eyebrows to be wiggling around. And so the crabs are more mobile. They move like crabs, and so they are fast and slow. They are very funny in places. I think you're absolutely right. They have the most character in the film. They're kind of a Greek chorus almost of sort of commenting on the film or their view of what's going on. You know, they don't seem too perturbed by him, his existence, but they don't seem to be worried about him either.
Don't think he ever killed any of them for food or out of anger. I mean, they get away. Maybe it's because their crab claws scare him. Now we're both making
crab claws at each other.
So now I really do want to watch The Little Mermaid.
Yes, yeah. Under the sea.
I just knew you would. So Wall-E is the actual comedy, though.
Yes.
This is the actual funny one with the actual jokes.
Yes.
And it is very funny.
Yes, it is. I mean, the cockroach is just one of the many things which are funny in it. And the cockroach, again, unlike many an animal psychic, kind of exists to be a deadpan viewer, you know, with us to look at it. There are moments where its tenacity are very funny and it's how it survives. And Wall-E is generally fond of it as well. It is his friend.
When he disappears into the Twinkie, and then his little antenna are poking out.
And, you know, there are points where Wall-E is worried that he's dead. And, of course, you cannot kill a cockroach. So, you know, and there are moments where things that should kill a cockroach that he bounces back from quite easily. So, and it's interesting that they both pick these scuttling sidekicks.
It's really weird. Like, maybe it's just, like, little creatures that make a noise wherever they go. Like, I think it's just a coincidence. And I just love the word scuttling. The other jokes in Wall-E. So, again, we have the satire sequence.
Yeah.
Which, as you say, I think it was a really good word used, overstuffed. I mean, sometimes the film does seem overstuffed. Nobody wants to see that thing of, you know, look at you lazy humans, you're all fat and attached to your computer all the time. Although, yes, that's me.
That is a thing. I mean, one of the interesting food aspects of it is, of course, that in the big and large spaceship world, they all drink protein shakes.
No joy of like normal food. It's just a cupcake and a cup.
Cupcake, and they're just sucking constantly out of their their giant big gulp.
Yeah. And although it's a kind of disgusting joke about they've lost bones, they've become bone-like because they haven't needed them, so they wouldn't have much in the way of muscles either. But, you know, actually, the kind of diet they have, they would be losing bone density.
I mean,
it is actually they all look a little bit like those documentaries you see about the world's heaviest man or the, yeah, you know, yeah, people who can't get through their front door and all that kind of thing. I mean, some of that does seem a bit kind of slammed home, obvious, you know, and obviously satire about big corporations. Thank you, Disney, for bringing that to my attention.
Pixar,
yeah. I mean, you know, Pixar are cool.
They hadn't quite done the deal at that point.
Oh, they hadn't? Okay, yeah, I think great.
It's the last film before the big deal, but it's okay. when Disney were trying to buy Pixar, actually.
So this is basically an independent film?
I wouldn't go that far. Disney's throwing money into it, but they had a distribution deal at the time.
I mean, you know, considering it's a film for kids and it's got this kind of silent comedy aspect to it, there isn't too much comedy just for the sake of laughs, you know, dropping things. I mean, they're not as much as you would expect. Isn't that joy in pratfalls?
It all becomes character comedy. So there is the little scrubber robot, which is constantly chasing Wally around. Yeah, because he's got these contaminants. And also discovers a degree of freedom by doing it, because in the first instance he realizes that he can move off the lines of power lines which they move around on, and certainly by the end of it is a fully fledged character in his own right. You know, the sort of One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest sequence with the defective robots, mm-hmm, and it is a Pixar thing in general, they're more interested in getting the comedy out of character than necessarily out of pratfalls. Though, you know, there are moments where Wally, particularly in that opening sequence, where there are slapstick moments, fire extinguisher, falling down, the whole stuff with the when the giant storm comes in and when he's locking in and all that kind of stuff. When he's showing Eve all of his treasures, she bangs him against the wall. She, you know, there's all sorts of stuff like that. So there are, but those are all character based as well. They're not just for the sake of the gag.
I mean, it's clearly the funnier film. I think it's quite interesting how the red turtle, which doesn't seem to have any, you wouldn't think it had any interest in humour, its themes, but it almost feels it needs to have a little bit of it just to break the tension, because it's almost the situation that the bloke is in is almost unbearable, and especially when he gets disheartened because he keeps, you know, failing to leave the island. You know, you have to have the crabs to keep you
it's
happy.
True. You do, but it does mean that you do get a wry smile every now and then. And I think the crabs do a lot of that heavy lifting.
Well, you know, crabs, they can lift a lot. Right?
They can, like they ants. Can. Yeah. But not as much as the cockroach can.
The cockroach does nout.
Yeah, because it's a cockroach. He doesn't need to. It's all there. The world is built for him now. Finally, the cockroaches will inherit the earth.
So I think it's quite clear that we're going to go with, I'm going to go with Wall-E.
Yes, as am I. Sorry, I thought you were going to go for comedy. If we're talking about sidekicks, then the crabs are slightly better as individual sidekicks. But yeah, for comedy, Wall-E wins.
Okay, we're going to end with the beginning now. We're going to talk about creation myths. Although Wall-E talks about the end of the world, and I suggested earlier there's a hint of that in Red Turtle, we feel like we're in kind of like Genesis country.
Rebirth, yeah. I mean, it is no surprise Eve is called Eve. I mean, that is the, you know,
because she's the only woman around also.
Yes, yeah, exactly.
I'm sure
yeah.
the turtle woman's called Eve as well.
I bet she is, yeah. And bet he's called Adam and all that. At least Wall-E wasn't called Adam.
No, he's allowed to have his own personality.
Of course, yes, indeed. Sorry. Very much so. I mean, Eve does get a personality. As opposed to Turtle Woman, Eve does have a personality. It is... I'm not convinced it's going to pass the Bechdel test anytime soon, Wall-E.
No. I meant to say, actually, when we're talking about romance, there's a bit where two of the fat humans get unplugged from their devices and they just look at each other and it's like, zing! Yeah. And you think, God, this is just how it works, clearly.
So, yeah, creation myths. The red turtle feels mythic. It feels like, if someone had told me, yes, this is the myth of the world, and the man was swept up out of nowhere and turned up on an island, and you know, because also it kind of makes no sense as well, in as much as, you know, he can't get off the island.
The turtle movie where the turtle becomes a woman and they have a baby. It kind of makes no sense.
I know, go figure. So he can't get off the island, he's kept on the island, and then when he kills the turtle, which is protecting him potentially, then she becomes the woman that he needs to create a life, which then goes off and potentially spawns more life elsewhere or goes and discovers what's happened to the world after the apocalypse that you've mooted. Broad enough.
If it's, even if it's not an apocalypse, there's obviously some, yeah. I think, a lot, oh, there's a lot of destruction. Yeah. And that's why I think it's important anyway. You can.
Yeah. No, I agree. And I think because actually without that, the tsunami is the only thing, the only external thing that happens in the story. Mm-hmm. It's the only thing, you know, it is kind of, if you were watching your Red Turtle weekly cartoon, that would be your story of the week.
Yeah.
And, you know, you could see a Red Turtle cartoon where lots of things happen like that. This week he learns to build a house.
Yeah.
You
know, I would so watch that.
Of course you would, yes. But at the end of the day, the creation myth, you know, it is so loose that it can easily, it's of mythic quality.
Yeah. You know,
partially because there's so little in it.
Well, yeah. So at this point, I want to do a little shout out to a very different podcast from ours, the Fatal Attraction podcast. So,
why did I know you were going to go to that one? I don't know why I thought, if we're talking about creation, Fatal Attraction is the way to go.
Yeah, because the erotic thriller is a really important genre here. Okay, let's Matthew from the Fatal Attraction podcast, who has actually been on the podcast before, is a delightful guest. We'll have him back. Anytime, Matthew. We'd be delighted to have you here. He was talking to me on Twitter about the Red Turtle, and he basically said, what does it mean? And I thought, I think I've got some ideas about what it might mean. But he prompted me to look into what turtles mean in Japanese sort of culture, and actually turtles are a symbol of Teenage Mutant Ninjas. Turtles in Japanese culture represent fidelity but also longevity, and mm-hmm. they're used in wedding ceremonies a lot, apparently, images of turtles. And I think that really here the turtle is protecting our hero and sort of making sure that the hero and his genes survive for a reason. That's why, you know, the turtle keeps him on the island and then makes him procreate and then protects his son. I mean, it's sure that, you know, the turtle's very protective of the son. And I think that there is an element of somehow nature or whatever is protecting this man and his sort of genes for a reason. I think that that makes it a creation myth in a way. For me, that's the whole point in the film, is that, you know, that they have to survive the tsunami. You know, if he goes out on the raft, he'll never survive anything, let alone an incident like that. So it's a kind of Noah's Ark. The island becomes a kind of Noah's Ark, and the turtle is Noah. I've lost it.
I was just seeing how far you could go with that one. And obviously, you know,
think I'm right.
That's definitely a reading that works. I think the interesting thing also would be that you could read it like, say, the Alien films, mm-hmm. that he's being menaced by this alien creature, a turtle, and then when he thinks he's killed it, mm-hmm. when the facehugger has dropped off, it then turns into something that then gets impregnated and turns and comes up with a hybrid creature, which then breaks his heart at the end of the film. I just came up with that, and it's a rubbish theory.
It's quite rubbish, actually.
It is, yeah.
I say this as a friend, but
I know, that's fine. I'm happy with that. Does it have enough depth for a proper creation myth? But it has the bit in the middle. Has the bit, so you can say, like, with Adam and Eve, where's Adam and Eve? And then there's a thing happened.
And now there's a race of half man, half turtle people.
Indeed.
Again, mutant.
Teenage Mutant. Now this is a prequel.
Teenage Mutant Turtle. He is what, at the end of the film.
That's exactly what he is. He's half human, half turtle. He's gone out there. He's swimming clearly like a turtle.
He's got a way with a spear. He could totally learn some ninja moves.
Indeed, yes. Yeah. So, yeah, it's all there.
Okay, I'm going to get kicked out of Sight and Sound now.
No, they're going to like this kind of stuff. Now, yeah, Wall-E creation myth, obviously it leans on Judeo-Christian creation myth around the Adam and Eve stuff.
It does indeed.
But also it's his own recreation myth of coming back to Earth and reseeding, you know. And
from New York, which is where it will all start.
It all starts and it all ends again. This idea of, and it's quite a classic science fiction trope, to come and either see the new world or come back to destroyed Earth, and now we've learned the ways.
What's that line at the end of the Apes movie? Damn you all.
Damn you all to hell. You did it, yeah. It's all there. And you know, it is a good science fiction film. It is a good, you know, that storyline. So the other film that I wanted to do, or the other film I posited doing here, which actually would make is a good film as a sort of triangular version, was Silent Running, which I know you haven't seen.
I haven't seen Silent Running. I mean, my feeling was that would take us in slightly different territory, but actually it would work. It works once you've made the jump from the Red Turtle to Wall-E. Yeah. I think, yeah.
Yes, and suddenly it makes a bigger jump. And I think, but I wanted to do Silent Running because I felt it had that sort of sense of ambiguous creation myth again about it, that, you know, this is the start. There is a question about the Red Turtle storyline from the kid's point of view, mm-hmm. because in the end, Now they never chat, that we know. I'm not even sure they can talk to each other properly apart from grunts, because they never do.
They'll find their own language.
They do a bit of pictogram drawing at one point. So, but do you think he ever asked where they came from? You know, his dad says, I came from over there.
Mm.
She never says that she came from a turtle.
Well, exactly. I mean, this is one thing I find quite frustrating about the character. But, you know, I do think there's a reason I mentioned that quote from the animator, you know, when he said, you know, when you talk about these things, you ruin the magic. Yeah. Because if he started saying, well, obviously she symbolises the protection of the human race or something like that, you know, you ruin it all. I mean, you wanted Silent Running and I wanted All Is Lost.
Yeah.
But you refuse to watch. You find All Is Lost depressing, and I read it entirely as a Christian film. And I read it as a man who's casting off his material things and, you know, finding his place in the afterlife, you know, in the arms of the Lord. It might mean he's dying, but he's going to heaven. He's going to a better place. So you can see why...
Really, I didn't get at all from it. So,
no,
yeah, exactly.
I mean, I completely, you know, again, you know, you've got the consumerism. You know, his ship is scuppered by a crate of shoes.
Yeah.
And, you know, and then he has to ditch all his stuff, like his golden sextant and so on. So I think, you know, from that point of view, my reading of The Red Turtle, like my reading of All Is Lost, you know, it puts us back into that kind of religious spiritual territory. I think that although Wally talks about creation and rebirth and, you know, it really goes into detail, and I love the fact that children will watch this film and they'll grow up thinking about environmental issues.
Hopefully.
Fun.
They should be now.
If it's not outlawed
in
certain countries, for me, the Red Turtle is a really powerful creation myth, however slight.
Yeah, I think the Red Turtle works better as a creation myth. Partially because it feels mythical as well, you know, and because it leans on those tropes really well. Its mythicalness is what means it gets through the fact that not much happens, that it is so, you know, because it feels that, so it reaches for that kind of grandeur and actually does achieve it.
Mm.
So, you know, I'm not going to disagree with you at all on that one.
You're not going to disagree. Okay, right. So I'm just going to add those up. I noticed that halfway through, and I possibly shouldn't have noticed halfway through, that we were level pegging. But yeah, again, it's a draw. 6 points to the Red Turtle and 6 points to Wall-E. And I'm really happy with that. I'm glad that the Red Turtle held its own against a much-loved American classic.
Yeah, I think if we have to have a tiebreaker, which one earworms you more?
Well, in which case, it's obviously got to be Hello, Dolly.
Yes.
But that's not one of the films we're talking about. I am massively heartened by The Red Turtle because I really like the idea of modern silent films, or, you know, films that use the techniques of silent film. And The Red Turtle just proves that in yet another genre, you know, animation, it can be done, it can be done beautifully. It holds its nerve throughout, which a lot of modern silents don't, you know.
Absolutely, yeah.
You know, it really, really is a wonderful film, and I hope that everyone who listens to Silent Learning podcasts will support it. Yeah, and also just go and watch Wall-E again this weekend.
In the end, both of these films lean so much on silent movies that I think they were the inspired pairing.
And they were, and actually, you know, as you may have guessed from listening to this podcast, we agonised over this pairing.
Yeah,
it took
a lot
of time. So I hope you've enjoyed listening to us thrash this out.
Yes, in the meantime, you'll be going to San Francisco?
Yes, indeed. I am going to the San Francisco Silent Film Festival just in a couple of days' time. I hope to do a little podcast report from there. So that may be your next podcast, but we will be back with The Sound Barrier in 2 weeks, and we already know what we're going to do. And again, we're twisting the format slightly, but not too much.
Fritz Lang's Destiny is being re-released, and so I'll be picking up a preview screening of that just before we record, and the pairing film will be...
to be announced.
Yes. If you can think of something that you want us to pair with Destiny, then do so.
Yeah, do let us know what you think would go well with The Weary Death.
From all of history.
From all of film history.
Well, film history, yeah.
Yeah. Thanks for listening to The Sound Barrier. The Red Turtle is out in cinemas now, and Wall-E is available on DVD and Blu-ray and various places where you can stream it as well. The Sound Barrier is presented in association with Sebas Radio, so thanks to them. Thanks to you, Pete.
Thank you, Pamela.
Well, it's a pleasure. Goodbye.
Goodbye.
Put on your Sunday clothes, there's lots of world out there. Get out the brilliantine and dime cigars. We're gonna find adventure in the evening air. Girls in white in a perfume night with the lights as bright as the stars. Put on your Sunday clothes, we're gonna ride through town in one of those new horse-drawn open cars. We'll see the shows at Delmonico's, and we'll close the town in a whirl, and we won't come home until we kiss a girl.